merciful, Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, since we were asked to speak something tonight about death and what might possibly come after that, I picked the verse, what I thought was an appropriate verse from the Bhagavad Gita that we could start off with. It's from the 8th chapter, it's text 5. And since I'm pretty much the only person here with the book, I'll just have to, I'll chant the Sanskrit or read the Sanskrit and then read the translation and purport and then say something about that. So this is chapter 8, text 5. Actually, is this loud enough? Can everybody hear me okay? All right. Antakale chamameva smaram muktva kalevaram ya prayati samadbhavam yati nashti atrasamshaya. Translation. And whoever, at the end of his life, quits his body, remembering me alone, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. So this is Lord Sri Krishna speaking. Should mention that. And I'll read that translation again. He says, whoever, at the end of his life, quits his body, remembering me alone, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. And this is Srila Prabhupada's purport. And this verse, the importance of Krishna consciousness is stressed. Anyone who quits his body in Krishna consciousness is at once transferred to the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is the purest of the pure. Therefore, anyone who is constantly Krishna conscious is also the purest of the pure. The word smaran, remembering, is important. Remembrance of Krishna is not possible for the impure soul who has not practiced Krishna consciousness in devotional service. Therefore, one should practice Krishna consciousness from the very beginning of life. If one wants to achieve success at the end of his life, the process of remembering Krishna is essential. Therefore, one should constantly and incessantly chant the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lord Chaitanya has advised that one be as tolerant as a tree, Taro Iva Sahishnuna. There may be so many impediments for a person who is chanting Hare Krishna. Nevertheless, tolerating all these impediments, one should continue to chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So that at the end of one's life, one can have the full benefit of Krishna consciousness. Namaham Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastai Buddhalaya Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Govardhavani Pracharni Nivashisha Sunyavadi Pastrachari Shatarni. So how many of our guests are here for the first time? Okay, one. And how many of our guests are here not for the first time, but, you know, for the first half dozen times, newcomers basically to Krishna consciousness? Okay, so we have, okay, few. Okay, for the benefit of them, I'm going to try to present what I have to say in such a way that it could be interesting and understandable to our new guests, but simultaneously of some relevance to those of us who have, you know, been around for years and years and years. So it's not always easy to do that. So please give me your blessings. I'll try my best. Okay, so one of the first thoughts I had about this subject of death is I was just reflecting on how many different ways it could happen. There's a lot. I was just the other day, I was checking out the news on on the internet. I was looking at one web page, and I noticed there was an article about how North Korea was testing long-range missiles. North Korea, as everybody knows, is a country that's kind of has some belligerent attitude towards, you know, the United States. And they're developing nuclear warheads. They might have them already, or if they don't, they're pretty darn close. And, you know, the United States is worried about that. It's something they're very concerned about because they're not confident that if they have these nuclear warheads and if they have the capability of using them, that they won't. So anyway, when I saw that article about them, you know, running these tests on long-range missiles, I thought, this is getting scary. So I rang up my father. He's a retired electrical engineer, and he worked in the defense industry. In other words, the company he was working for did contracts for the Air Force and the armed forces. And so he knew, you know, I figured he'd know something about this. So I just asked him the question. I said, hey, Dad, if the Koreans actually, North Koreans, get this long-range missile, you know, and I said, they already have nuclear warheads, don't they? He said, no. He said, they don't have them yet, but they're in the process. They're developing them, and they're getting closer all the time. I said, so, you know, what happens if they get the nuclear warheads and they launch a long-range missile? You know, long-range, because Korea, everybody knows, is just on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. If they have long-range missiles that are accurate and they have nuclear warheads, they could take out San Diego, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. One go. You know, it's all within the range of a long-range missile. You know? So, you know, what's the chance? I mean, do we have anything that could stop that? You know, and it's like, is there a counter defense? Is there a way to intercept these questions? We'll take questions at the end. Questions and comments at the end, if that's okay. And he said, well, you know, we've been working, the United States Armed Forces has been working for years on ways to, you know, deal with that. I said, well, how effective are they? And he said, well, you know, maybe 50%. I said, oh. He said, well, and he qualified that. He said, even that is hard to say because, you know, when they've run tests, when they run their tests, they know that a missile is being launched at a particular time. They know where it's coming from, and they know its trajectory. They know where it's going to. So, you know, like when they run these tests, they have the unfair advantage of knowing when the missile is launched, where it's coming from, and, you know, it's as I said, its trajectory like that, its course. And that gives it, that's a big advantage because he said, but in the event of a real attack, we wouldn't know that a missile had been launched until it was pretty darn close, you know? And then he also made another point that he said, you know, you can't, when you actually try to intercept the missile, he said, you can't do that from very far away. In other words, a missile has to be pretty close before you can send something up to try to intercept it. You can't intercept a missile that's still 1,000 miles away or 500 miles away or something like that. It has to be pretty much right over the target. I said, well, you know, could they do that? He said, yeah, they have things, you know, they have missiles that could possibly intercept other missiles. He said, but there was one problem. I said, what's that? He said, the warheads now are designed in such a way that when they come close to the target, they split. You know, there'll be a single missile coming, and all of a sudden when it gets close to the target, this is like, you know, a countermeasure. When it gets close to the target, it'll split. And so I thought maybe, okay, it'll split into two, but it can split into as many as 6, 7, or 8, missiles all of a sudden. And no one knows which one is the warhead. So, you know, they don't know which one to try to intercept. So the chances of intercepting it are pretty slim. So in other words, you know, if there was some rogue state that all of us decided that they really didn't like us or any other country for that matter, and they wanted to attack with a nuclear missile, there's a pretty good chance it would be effective. That, you know, at least they'd get the first blow in there, they'd get the first punch in. I mean, there could be a counterattack, obviously, but it'd be very difficult to intercept that. So anyway, it's just something I was thinking about, in the process of reflecting on all these different ways we could go. Then, just like, for instance, another thing I noticed when I was looking through the news, there was just the other day there was an earthquake in Italy, 6.2 according to the Richter scale, and which is a pretty powerful earthquake. And from what I could understand, this earthquake, took out about 200 people. Unfortunately, about 200 people lost their lives, and I think another 1,500 were severely injured, and about, I can't remember the figure, I think it was 50,000 or 100,000 are homeless. The town was devastated. So I was just, you know, thinking about that. I was thinking, well, you know, here we are in Southern California. We're on a fault, the San Andreas Fault, and everybody's always talking about the big one, you know. When will the big one? That's another possible way that people, you know, we could all go. The big one could come along. If we don't get nuked by the North Koreans, the big one could come along and take out all of Southern California. Where we're sitting right now could become part of the ocean very easily, you know. That's another way. And then this is all in the course of, like, you know, 1 or 2 days looking at the news. Then there was another article about one of the star pitchers for the Angels, the Anaheim Angels, was, you know, killed in a car accident. He was just coming, you know, just coming of age, so to speak. He was just really coming into his own right as a star pitcher. And he had a car accident, and that was the end of it right there. And, of course, there's, you know, always some new disease coming up, which is, you know, threatening people's lives. So anyway, there's so many different ways we can go. And people are, you know, the reason these articles are there is because people are concerned. And we should be concerned. You know, we should be concerned because it's natural that, you know, nobody wants to die. So it's natural that we're concerned about all these different ways in which it could possibly happen. But the point I'd like to make is, I think, more important than being concerned about how we could possibly die or when we could possibly die, we should be more concerned about what we can do about it. You know, is there anything we could do about it? Death. And it's something worth discussing. And actually, before we can discuss that intelligently, we have to define a little bit, or discuss a little bit, what we mean by death. In other words, what is our understanding of death? Because not everybody has the same understanding of death. And depending upon what your understanding is about death, that will have a lot of bearing, or determine a lot what your possible responses to that phenomena might be. Like, for instance, the modern scientific understanding of death is that death is the end of everything. When you die, that's it. Lights out. Game over. Finito. Nothing. No more experience. When death, as far as modern science is concerned, is the end of you as an individual, and the end of you as a conscious, experiencing individual. That's it. Forever and ever. Okay, so that's one understanding of death. Now that's, but there are others. I mean, like, for instance, here in America, in large parts of the Western world, Christianity is, to say, the predominant religion, and the religious worldview, at least of Christianity, differs from the scientific worldview. They believe that, according to that worldview, that when you die, that's a time of judgment. That's the moment of judgment. At that time, everybody, every human being, when they die, they will be judged. And if they've accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior, then they will go to heaven forever. And if they haven't, then they will go to the bad place forever. They'll go to hell forever. So that's their idea. See, so it's very different from the idea you get from science, right? And then, of course, then there's our idea, which is more similar to the Christian idea than the scientific idea. Our idea is that, yeah, it's true. There is, at the time of death, we will be judged. And if we qualify, as we just heard described in this verse, if we qualify in the sense that if we're remembering the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, at the time of death, if we're absorbed in thought of Him, you know, as a result of practicing spiritual life, specifically devotional service to Krishna throughout our entire lifetimes, then it is a final judgment, in the sense that we will go back to the spiritual world and be able to live with Krishna eternally in the spiritual world, you know, being engaged in a personal relationship with Him. But if we fall short of that, if we don't quite have that qualification, then according to the Vedic worldview, the Vedic literature, that the soul will take birth again in this material world, because we'll get another material body. Because if we don't qualify to have a spiritual body at the time of death, then we will receive another material body, and we will get further opportunity to qualify ourselves, you know, through that, you know, next material body we receive. So the question then is, okay, well, you know, which of these is true? You know, people these days are becoming increasingly how would you say it? Disinterested in dogmatism. Dogmatism means that, you know, a dogmatic person is somebody who's just expecting that you to accept something, accept a statement they make based on authority. That's, you know, dogmatic. Accepting it just because some authority says it. Now, these days, people aren't so attracted by that. They don't like that idea that I should just have to accept something just because some authority says so. People are more interested, they like the idea of facts that are supported by evidence. Okay, let's do it like that. Because, you know, that's fair enough. I mean, because otherwise you can just have a standoff. I mean, science is saying one thing, and that, you know, you should accept it because we're science, we're saying this. And Christianity is saying another, you know, something else. And if they're also coming, you know, presenting the same line of reasoning, you know, we're Christianity. You should, based on the authority of the Bible, you should accept that what we say is correct. And if we just come along and also say, well, you know, we're Krishna consciousness, you should accept what we're saying based on the authority of the Vedic literature. People, they just draw a blank. They go, well, you're all saying you're the authority, and you're all saying we should accept what you're just saying because you're the... So they need something different, or it's helpful. So, okay, so the question has to be raised then, is there any evidence? Is there any evidence we can find that, you know, out there in the world, which will tend to support one of these worldviews and simultaneously, obviously, would contradict the other two? Is there anything out there like that? Well, interestingly enough, there is. There is. Actually, there's an abundance of evidence of that type, but I'll just talk about one tonight because it's very germane or very relevant to the topic of the tonight's talk, which is, you know, death and what could possibly be happening afterwards, and that's reincarnation. Okay? There is evidence to support the phenomena, the idea that reincarnation is something that happens. And it comes, and it can be found in a very interesting place. It's actually, it's found in the work of not just one person, but of many mainstream scientists. They're mainstream in the sense that these are scientists who are recognized by other scientists. They have all the credentials. You know, they have credentials like an arm long. They've published in peer-reviewed journals, written books, which are, you know, accepted in scientific circles. Their methodology is the same as of the scientists. Okay, so in that sense, they're mainstream, but they're presenting very non-mainstream findings. Okay, so an example of one such scientist is a man named Ian Stevenson. He passed away about 2 years ago, but he spent about the last 30, 40 years of his life researching this phenomena of young children who remember a previous lifetime. So this is something that actually is mentioned in our literature as well. In one of our books, it's called the Krishna Book. It's sort of like the postgraduate study to this book I was reading from tonight, the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada, in one story, it's called the story of this King Nigger, who is a particular king. So anyway, in that, Prabhupada refers to this phenomenon. He says he's describing here a person, children who can remember a past life. He says, such a person who remembers his past life is called Jati Smara. In modern times, and that's the Sanskrit name for somebody who can remember their past life. So it says, in modern times also, there are instances of small children recalling many details of their past lives. Okay, so that statement is there in one of our books. And as I mentioned, this is something that different scientists have, and in particular, this one man in particular, have done extensive research in. I'll just read you, this is a book I have here, it was written by that man, Ian Stevenson, called Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. And I'll just read you the little blurb here on the back of the book here. It says, children who claim to remember a previous life have been found in many parts of the world, particularly in the Buddhist and Hindu countries of South Asia, among the Shiite peoples of Lebanon and Turkey, the tribes of West Africa, and the American Northwest. Stevenson has collected over 2,600 reported cases of past life memories, which include 65 detailed reports, of which 65 detailed reports have been published. Specific information from children's memories has been collected. Gotta listen to this carefully now. Okay, specific information from children's memories has been collected and matched with the data of their former identity, family, residence, and manner of death. In other words, these kids are able to produce verifiable details. You know, it's not that they're just rambling on like a lot of childish gibberish. They're presenting information which, when these researchers, these case investigators, take that information, they can verify it. You know, the kid says, oh, I used to live in such and such a place. My name was so-and-so. My parents, were like this. And, they're presenting all sorts of information. And then the caseworkers, they go out and they can match it up. They can match it up with their former identity, family, residence, and manner of death. And here's something very interesting. It says, birthmarks or other physiological manifestations have been found to relate to experiences of the remembered past life, particularly violent death. And those of you who are finding this really interesting, if you like, at the end of the class, you can come up, because this book actually has pictures. And I could show you the pictures, and what you'll be seeing is pictures of a child, who remembered being killed by being stabbed in the chest, you know, 7 times, okay, in the past life. And then they have a birthmark, you know, on their body, and it shows 7 stab marks, and you can actually see the picture of that. Or somebody else remembers being, they were shot, you know, and they say, well, I was shot in the head, and I think I was shot, like, from underneath the head. And then there'll be a picture, and that person has a birthmark where the bullet goes in, and then there's another birthmark where the bullet came out. I can show you the picture. And like that. So the pictures are right there. You know? So it's kind of like, makes it even, the case is more stronger and more compelling. Then it goes on to say here, writing as a specialist in psychiatry and as a world-renowned scientific investigator of reported paranormal events, Stevenson asks us to suspend our Western tendencies to disbelieve in reincarnation and consider the reality of the burgeoning record of cases now available. And he himself investigated 2,600. There's many, many more cases than that, you know. And now there's other researchers. They're coming in all the time. So it goes on to say. So this book is a summary of a multi-volume work entitled Reincarnation and Biology. Which is his main work, and it's 2 books that are about like 2,500 pages each, where all these cases are presented. With excruciating details and a lot of pictures as well. And so that's there. So, and even the American Medical Association, which is about as conservative an organization as you can possibly get, made a statement in one of their journals that, you know, he's brought forward a lot of, dispassionate research on this subject. He's very carefully done the work and to accept the scientific standards. And they said his research cannot be just put aside or overlooked. So he got acknowledgement from the American Medical Association, even though his views, this idea that reincarnation is something that's completely, unacceptable to that worldview, of the American Medical Association, but they respected him as a scientist and the way he went about doing his work. So that's kind of interesting. So where does that bring us? Where does that put us? Well, it puts us here. Let's just do like a little exercise in logic, okay? Let's just say that this is true. Let's just say, for argument's sake, that yeah, reincarnation is something that happens, that these kids really are remembering a past life, as is, the thesis of this book and of this man, the scientist. So let's assume that's true. Okay, so this is like a little exercise in logic. So, B, let's call that A, that this is true, okay? And B and C would stand for the worldview of modern science and the worldview of Christianity, okay? So B and C contradict A, okay? And there's A being that reincarnation or the Vedic worldview and that this is something that's true, and B and C would be modern science and Christianity. So B and C contradict A. A is true. Then therefore what follows is B and C must be false. Simple logic. You know, if B and C contradict A, but A is true, B and C must be false. And that's what we have. So basically what I'm saying is, just in one fell swoop, you know, we can eliminate the validity, assuming this is true, we can eliminate by process of elimination, we could eliminate the validity of the two other major worldviews that are competing for, you know, people's attention as what, you know, explanations of reality, which is specifically science and Christianity. Because as far as science is concerned, reincarnation is something that cannot happen. Not possible, because as we said right in the beginning of the class, as far as science is concerned, that there's no conscious self that survives the death experience. Consciousness is generated by neural impulses. In other words, when the brain is dead, that's it. That's the end of everything. There's no mind separate from the brain. So if you don't have a healthy working brain, you don't have a mind. If you don't have a mind, you don't experience anything. So as far as science is concerned, it's an impossibility. So if it is, but then again, so if it's something that is happening, that means the scientific worldview is in need of serious revision, to say the least. In other words, it's wrong. And the same thing, Christianity. As far as Christianity is concerned, this is something that doesn't happen. It's stated in their, you know, in their scripture, that it's appointed for man to die once and then the judgment. And even some of the personalities who are recognized by them as saints have come out and made very strong statements against that idea of, you know, reincarnation. Like, for instance, Augustine said reincarnation is ridiculous. See, so is, once again, if this is really true, if this is happening, then okay, you can forget about that worldview. So what are you left with? We have to look for a worldview that supports the evidence. You know, Vedic worldview is one such worldview. It's, you know, as I mentioned, not only is reincarnation one of the, you know, the foundational ideas throughout the Bhagavad Gita and all the Vedic literatures, but even this phenomenon specifically, even this phenomenon of children, young children remembering their past lives is mentioned within the literature, as I just read you earlier. So this doesn't, you know, this little exercise we just did here in logic and like that doesn't prove that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, by having done this, I haven't proved that God is a blue cowherd boy who expands himself into 16,108 forms to dance with the gopis and the rasa dance, or later on to marry 16,108 wives, or, you know, or none of these things. It doesn't prove that. But what it does do is this: at least it gives us reason to give further serious consideration to this worldview. You know, here he is, just by this little exercise, we could see that, okay, it appears that, once again, if this is something that's happening, then Krishna consciousness is, okay, it's right there. It's right, you know, it's right on the money, so to speak, you know, whereas science and Christianity are totally, you know, those worldviews are totally bewildered by this. So at least we should be prepared to give the Vedic worldview further serious consideration. And meaning we should be prepared to, inquisitive, we should be eager to hear what more does the Vedic worldview have to say about life? You know, what else does it say? Okay, so it's saying that reincarnation is something that happens. Well, what else does it say? Okay, well, we'll mention a few things and then we'll talk about that. It mentions that, okay, that, you know, yeah, we are, it's the soul. We are, it's the soul that's reincarnating from one body to the other, and that actually that's who we really are. We're not these material bodies, we're eternal spiritual beings. And in all the Vedic literatures, right, you know, even in the most elementary or introductory Vedic literature, the Bhagavad Gita, which we read from tonight, it explains that the soul is an eternal, has an eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna, who is the Supreme Soul. In other words, there's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita. It goes, Mamai Vamso Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Krishna says, the living entities are my eternal fragmental parts and parcels. In other words, according to the Vedic worldview, we are the spiritual offspring of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We are eternal spiritual beings, and Krishna, or God, is the supreme eternal spiritual being. And we're like his spiritual children. We're just like, in this world, mother and father have offspring. Well, we're Krishna's spiritual offspring. We're eternally related to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, like that. See? And I'm just giving you, like, you know, as I said, you, what else does the Vedic worldview say? Well, these are a couple things. So it says that, and it says that we have, this, as I said, we have an eternal spiritual relationship with him. And it's a very, it's a loving relationship. And how we wound up here in this material world as well, in order for there to be a loving relationship between any two people, in any, you know, spiritual or material, there has to be free will. So otherwise, it's not meaningful. Now, it's like, just like here in this material world, if you know you can't, if you try to force somebody to love you, that's then all of a sudden immediately it's not love. You see, so Krishna allows us, his spiritual offspring, to have a little bit of free will, because he wants it to be, in order for our relationship with him to be love, really meaningful, and be love, that has to be there. You know, Krishna doesn't want slaves or robots. He wants to reciprocate loving feelings with, you know, people who really want to love him. And he'll love them back. So, those of us who are here in this material world, right here tonight, we misused our free will. And everybody else that you see here in this material world, we're here because we misused our free will. We made the mistake of thinking we could become happy living in defiance or rebellion to the will of Krishna, as opposed to using our free will properly to try to serve him and favorably and love him and glorify him and like that. So we're here to learn a lesson, basically. And when we learn that lesson, you know, through various means, then we go back to Krishna to live with him once again eternally in the spiritual world. So that's what else the Vedic worldview has to say. I mean, among other things, but that's perhaps the most significant. That's the main message, so to speak. Okay, so, but how do we know that, you know, is there any, because remember, back a few minutes ago, we were talking about, you know, we're not, these days people are less interested in dogmatic claims. You know, they're more interested in facts that have evidence to support them. Okay, well, what about these things? Okay, you know, isn't it just because somebody's right about something, does that mean they're right about everything? In other words, can any of these statements I just made, can they be supported by evidence? Or are they just claims? You know, they're just dogmatic religious claims that all those things are so. Well, and that's legitimate for somebody to respond like that, you know. Because, like, for instance, I'll give you a couple examples. Like, there's a person in India. I won't mention a name, but he's reputed as being able to make gold appear in his hands, you know. Or maybe a wristwatch or something else. You know, he can make things appear, right? And people, on the strength of that, they go as far to say, he's God. Now, it's one thing to be able to make a wristwatch or some gold or something appear or some ashes come out of your hand, right? But it's another thing to be God. You see? They're two different things. See? He actually might be doing that. You know, of course, it might be just some trick as well, but he might be doing that because there are people who have mystic power. You know, there is such a thing as mystic cities, and there are people who could do that. You know, the mystic cities are mentioned in the Vedic literature. Anima, Lagima, Prapti, you know, the ability to make oneself smaller than the smallest, the ability to make things appear at will. These different mystic powers are described there in the Vedic literature. And people, different people have them. People who are not even you know, very spiritual have those powers. You know, even demoniac people can have these mystic powers. So it's certainly not a qualification that one can be God. So the point I'm making is this, that, okay, somebody might be right about a little something. That doesn't mean that you can't extrapolate. You can't go over, you know, overboard and, you know, think, like, for instance, scientists, they can, okay, you know, send a rocket to outer space. That's pretty impressive. I mean, you know, it's pretty impressive to get a rocket together that you can send out to outer space, and you could have orbiting the Earth, and, you know, they do have satellites up there and everything. So, you know, they've done it. It's not just a total bluff. I mean, Prabhupada, our spiritual master, said some of the things that they're claiming to have done perhaps are bluffs and lies, but they've done some things that are pretty impressive. But it's not because they've done that we can, you know, have to accept them as the authorities on everything. You know, that we have to accept everything they say about you know, the nature of life and reality. No. You know, they know up to a certain point. So anyway, so the point being that, okay, it is possible for somebody to get a little something correct, but not necessarily be an authority on everything. So somebody might say, well, the same thing holds true for the Vedic literature. Okay, you guys got something right. Reincarnation. You're right. And it just so happens it is explained in your literatures, in your worldview. It's accounted for. Whereas it's not accounted for in the worldview of science. It's not accounted for in the worldview of the other religions, and it is accounted for in your philosophy very nicely. Okay, so you get credit for that. But that doesn't mean you're an authority on everything. That's true. Okay, so then where does the verification come in? Well, it comes in this way, okay? And this is a very nice thing about the Vedic worldview. Some aspects of it are externally verifiable, such as what we just mentioned, reincarnation, okay? The rest of it is, but the rest of it is totally verifiable, but not by an empiric method. In other words, the rest of the whole Vedic worldview is verifiable, but it's internally verifiable. And I'll try to explain what I mean by that. In other words, you know, there's no, just like, okay, reincarnation, there's empiric evidence for it. But that, you know, Krishna was a blue cowherd boy? No. There's no empiric evidence to support that. Or that he, you know, expanded himself into 16,108 forms? No. That he lifted Govardhan Hill, you know, effortlessly and with the pinky of his left hand that held it in place for you know, 7 days and nights? Empiric evidence to support that? No. Okay, so then what is the evidence? Well, as I said, it's internally verifiable in the sense that the Vedic literatures describe a process which enables any individual, anybody, you know, can purify their consciousness, and then they can experience for themselves these things. You know, they can, as they will have realization of the veracity of this philosophy as a result of performing a particular type of an experiment on themselves. So in other words, in that sense, it's internally verifiable. I'll read a quote here from this is from a book written by one of the principal followers of Lord Chaitanya, who was an incarnation of Krishna that was present here on earth 500 years ago. So one of his followers wrote a book called the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. In that book, there was this statement. It says, in the beginning, he's describing this process that I'm referring to of internal verification for the whole Vedic worldview. This is how it works. He says, in the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instructions, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. See? So you just take it step by step. If you do this, and as if you say somebody is initially, they're prepared to give this the benefit of the doubt, that they hear this philosophy and they think, well, this makes a bit of sense, in other words. I'm putting it in plain and simple language, in other words. And then you start associating with somebody who's, you know, been involved with this for a long time and who's considered accomplished, you know, who's made some advancement, who's spiritually advanced. You associate with somebody like that. Initially, the first level of internal verification is you'll be impressed by that person's qualities, by their character, by their behavior. But that's just, you know, that doesn't end there. Then if you are intelligent and you're fortunate enough and you actually follow their directions and how to live your life, you'll experience a transformation in your own consciousness, and that's described here. It says, first you, in the next stage you become initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instructions, the neophyte devotee, beginner, okay, begins the process of devotional service. And here's what happens. Here's what you experience, and here's the internal verification. It says, by execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes freed from all material attachment. That's the first step. That's the first thing you experience. Okay, then the next thing is you attain steadiness and self-realization. You acquire a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. This taste leads one further forward to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. So that's what you experience, step by step, as you engage in the process. See? So, in other words, it's not like Krishna consciousness is just asking people to accept what it's saying in blind faith. It is calling for faith, but it's reasonable faith as opposed to blind faith. It's reasonable faith because why? Because here this is being offered. This process is being offered by which one can perform an experiment using yourself as the laboratory, so to speak, and then you could see for yourself. It's not blind faith, and it's not like you just have to accept it and that's it, and there's no way of ever knowing really or experiencing one way or the other whether it's true or not. No. Reasonable faith is that, okay, you know, give it the benefit of the doubt, tentatively to accept it as a tentative hypothesis, perform the experiment, engage in the process of devotional service, and then observe. Just like, you know, the scientific process is you have some hypothesis, then you perform some experiment, then you make observations, and then you come to a conclusion. So do that with Krishna consciousness, you know. You start off with a hypothesis. The hypothesis is this philosophy. We're not these material bodies. We're eternal spiritual beings. We're part and parcel of Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By engaging in devotional service, we revive our awareness of our eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna and reawaken our dormant love for Him. Okay, that's the tentative hypothesis. Okay, next step is the experiment. The experiment is, well, you engage in devotional service by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, as mentioned in the verse I read tonight, right at the beginning of the class, by following certain rules and regulations, such as, I'll get back to that. Okay, by following certain rules and regulations, and then the next step is, and then you watch what you observe to see what happens. Is my life the same? Is it getting worse? Is it staying the same? Or am I experiencing an improvement? Am I experiencing a transformation in my consciousness? You know, am I feeling more spiritual? Am I, you know, becoming free from different material desires that I had, which were just disturbing me and were unwanted? And am I feeling some, you know, pleasure, some, you know, positive pleasure in these activities of Krishna consciousness, like that? And then you can see for yourself. And if you are, then you know, then you've got it. If your experiment works, then you've arrived at the absolute truth. That, yeah, it must be true. Probably, you know, it's an expression, you judge a process by the result, or the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. See? So in other words, if you engage in the process of Krishna consciousness and you experience for yourself that it's working, and something's happening, you know, something's changing, then you know, then you can conclude. Then, which is the last step, you know, hypothesis, experiment, observation, conclusion. You can conclude that, yeah, this is the truth, that Krishna really is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We really are His parts and parcels, His eternal servants, and engaging in devotional service really is the ultimate, pure devotional service really is the ultimate, is the meaning and purpose of life and the ultimate goal. So, what are we doing for time? I think I could stop there perhaps and just see if maybe somebody has a question or a comment or something. Yeah, okay, this gentleman was right from the beginning. He had something he wanted to ask or add, so we have to give him a chance. Yeah, you have to speak really loud and really clear because I have 20/20 hearing, so I want to really. Oh yeah. Well, that's good to know. Thank you. Okay, thank you. This gentleman is very well informed from a military background. Or very well informed, or a combination of both. Thank you. That's one less thing we have to worry about. Now we could just worry about Pakistan and India. Actually, I was just recently in India. I just got back from India about a week ago. And I had the opportunity, I got to speak. I give a talk like this at the nuclear power plant, which is on the outskirts of Mumbai. And it's this huge setup. There's 10,000 people. They have 10,000 like engineers and physicists working there. And as I mentioned, it's right on the edge of the city, so to speak. And one of the people who took me there, after we got through all the security and everything, he pointed off in a particular direction. He says, "See that over those hills there?" He says, "That's a military installation over there." He says, "There's 800 military guarding that. No civilians are allowed in that area." And So, and the, you know, Pakistanis and the Indians are arch enemies now. So, you know, the point I was making is that, you know, there's no way of avoiding it. one way or the other, we're going to go. So whether it's, you know, through something like that or an accident or a disease or this or that, who can say, but we're going to go. So we should be more concerned about, you know, what can be done about the whole phenomenon of death as opposed to how we're going to go, when we're going to go, like that. Looks like we're, people are lining up for the Mahaprasadam. Anybody else? Any question about anything we said there or any other comments or additional information? Anta? Well, they have like a one-way eternality, you see? It's one way because they don't believe in the pre-existence of the soul. They believe that when you're born in this lifetime, that's the beginning. And then you get this one short lifetime, and everything, whatever you do in this one short lifetime will determine what happens to you eternally. In other words, if you get it right in this one short lifetime, you're fortunate. You can go back and live in heaven eternally with Jesus Christ. But if you blow it for some reason, and it's not difficult to do that, because imagine if you're born in the middle of some, Saudi Arabia or some really, very fundamentalist Muslim country where, or, you know, some place where you're not gonna hear about Christianity, what to speak of being able to have the opportunity to be favorably inclined towards it. I mean, it doesn't seem fair, you know? I mean, because if you don't get it right, according to what they say, you go to hell eternally. You know, it's eternal damnation. So that's their idea, and, I don't know. It doesn't seem consistent to me, consistent with the idea of like a God who's compassionate, loving, and even fair, just. It sounds like a pretty mean, nasty, kind of a grouchy sort of a God, you know, who will, after one short lifetime, which is not everybody's getting the same kind of chance, fair, you know, it's not like a, I mean, imagine you're born in the Bible Belt in some place in one of the, you know, Louisiana or something like that. And your father's a Baptist minister. You know, the person who's born in the middle of some African village or something like that is not getting the same kind of opportunity. And it's a pretty, important sort of a thing that's being judged there at the end. So that's what, on the basis of that, it just doesn't, even putting aside this evidence for reincarnation, which, as I said, is not consistent with their worldview, just on the basis of ordinary common sense and logic, it doesn't appeal, you know, to a lot of, you know, sensitive and intelligent people. And that, for that reason, a lot of people have kind of abandoned that, you know, religious worldview. Does that sort of address the point you're making there? Question? Sorry? Oh, yeah, sir. Yeah, right. As I said, it's not consistent. It's not consistent with the idea of a God who's compassionate, forgiving, loving. You know, it's just... Right. Yeah, and interesting you should mention that you felt Jesus Christ led you to... Yeah, because our temple president, when he spoke right at the beginning, he acknowledged that, you know, in this tradition, we don't... We disagree with Christianity, you know, with the beliefs of Christianity, but we don't have any problem with Jesus Christ. We believe that Jesus Christ was a pure devotee of Krishna. We refer to him as, he's what's referred to as a Shaktivesh avatar, which means he's a living entity that was empowered by Krishna to preach here in the material world for the purpose of helping people come closer to God. So we, you know, recognize him as such. And, we give him all respect and all honor and like that. But we think that his modern-day followers are misrepresenting him. That's our position as far as that goes. We feel that Jesus Christ is being misrepresented by modern-day Christianity. Okay, I'll tell you what. One last question and then we'll end it and then I'll talk to you personally. Yeah, go ahead. Say it again, loud. I think that... I'm not aware of evidence. I mean, there's statements. There's statements to the effect that something that doesn't happen, but I'm not aware of any evidence that, you know, clearly shows that it's something that doesn't happen. There's just claims. Yeah, according to the New Testament, reincarnation is something that doesn't happen. It's like, I quote it from the Bible. It's appointed for man to die once and then the judgment. That's the statement of the New Testament. Interestingly enough, though, just since you asked that, if you do some research into the history of Christianity, you'll find that it was quite a common belief among early Christians in the first 3 centuries, you know, before the Council of Nicaea, before the Nicene Creed. It was something that was commonly believed among early Christians, and they were called Gnostics. You know, and you could just go onto Google if you want to. I mean, it wouldn't be very difficult for you to find this out. Go on Google and just type in reincarnation in early Christianity, and you'll come up with a lot of websites that'll give you an insight. There's a lot of the early Christians believed in reincarnation, but at some point it was declared an anathema or a heresy, and then after that if somebody continued to believe in reincarnation from that point onwards, it was punishable by death, which was something that happened. They wiped out a whole group of people in the southern part of France called the Catholics because they persisted to believe in reincarnation. But anyway, well, I better stop there because everybody is kind of wanting to go to the feast, take Prashanam, and I don't want to take advantage here. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Hare Bol. If anybody does want to see these pictures, or if anybody wants to, talk a little bit more, I'm happy to hang around. So otherwise, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
No, it's not written by me. This is written by a man who's